Hi, this is John Harcher, and Happy New Year! Welcome to Episode 8 of Keep On Groovin'. 1992 was a relatively calm time for Hendrix releases, and nothing that would prepare everyone for the multitude of changes that would be coming very soon. Episode 8, The Alan Douglas Era, 1993 to 1995. Working for WMCA. Wait a minute, what's a Skinner reference doing here? Alan Douglas and estate lawyer Leo Branton must have had some ideas that Jimmy's back catalog and any future releases would do solid business, because they did something that came as a shock. They moved Jimmy's whole kit and caboodle from Reprise over to MCA. This was possibly due in part to Reprise's founder, a gentleman by the name of Francis Albert Sinatra. He made sure whoever was signed to the label completely owned the rights to their work. Reprise's other major rock artist has certainly taken this to heart, a Canadian named Neil Young. It shouldn't have come as too big a surprise, but it felt like a shock. What would they do with Jimmy's catalog? I was hoping that Bill Levinson would be involved in doing things with it. I spoke to him a couple of times in the mid-90s looking for a job. I think Jimmy only came up once in passing. I got the impression Alan was still firmly in charge, and he was, for a little while longer. This era of conflicting feelings began with the release of a collection called The Ultimate Experience. It came out in Europe in late 1992, but was MCA's first release in the States. It was a career-spanning collection, but for me it had a bit of a flaw. It was compiled based on a fan poll of their favorite Hendrix songs. Fans in the United Kingdom. I highly doubt US fans would have had Highway Child as one of their top 10 favorites. It only had one song for the post-Electric Ladyland era, not counting the Star Spangled Banner, that being Angel. 9 of the 12 tracks from the US version of Smash Hits were on it, so it was a decent enough supplement for that, considering all the other Hendrix albums were going out of print. Yep, everything Reprise just put back on the market a few years earlier was getting yanked off. But we were promised MCA would build the collection back. Their next release was a full rollout of remastered versions of the original 3 albums, with new covers, so they could all look just like Ultimate Experience when you put them in a box together. They were these flashy red and gold covers with Jimmy's picture on it, and on the back, in a small little box, they had the original covers for Are You Experienced, Axis Bold as Love, and Electric Ladyland. The choice was to buy the albums again just a few years after upgrading them from what Reprise did, or just pass. So I passed. They did do one thing right, though. Are You Experienced included everything from the US and UK versions, as well as the B-sides, so it was a practically complete package with all 17 songs, Red House from the UK version being the only thing missing. Almost all versions of Are You Experienced since then have done this. The Ultimate Experience compilation did sell pretty well, hitting number 25 in the UK at 72 in the US, eventually being certified triple platinum. You're selling 3 million copies, a lot of people still want to hear you. Jimi Hendrix Blues. A collection of recordings highlighting Jimi Hendrix as a blues artist should have been a no-brainer. That was on the agenda back in the 70s, even before 9 to the Universe's attempt to frame Jimi's jazz side. An album entitled Multicolored Blues was prepared, or at least the track listing was, but the album was either shelved or never made in favor of Midnight Lightning. In April 1994, this oversight was finally corrected. Like Jimmy's former label mate Neil Young's albums Rust Never Sleeps and Freedom, this album is bookended by acoustic and electric versions of the same song, Hear My Train A-Comin'. If it makes things any easier, you can refer to this version as Getting My Heart Back Together, since he never does the chorus in this version. He didn't do it at the BBC either. He might not have added it yet. This is the version from the soundtrack with Jimmy playing a restrung 12-string guitar, and it was the first time it appeared on CD. Next is Born Under a Bad Sign. There's an older song by guitarist Slim about bad luck, but this song is the best known one. It was recorded by blues great Albert King in 1967 during his time at Stax Records in the mid to late 60s. Within a year, Cream recorded their own version to include on Wheels of Fire. The version here was recorded in December 1969 with the band of Gypsies at the record plant. Unfortunately, it's just an instrumental, no vocals on it, so it was likely just a jam on a familiar song for the guys to get warmed up or inspired. No Hendrix blues collection would be complete without his first classic in the genre, Red House. And like Hear My Train A-Comin', it gets two slots on the album. The first is the original recording from December 1966 at CBS Studios used on the UK version of Are You Experienced. Noel played guitar on it, but played it like a bass, you know, just so it sounded lower to give the song something in the lower register. It's only available in mono, but the later version on Smash Hits and Kiss the Sky, recorded a month later at Delane Lea Studios, was in stereo. Considering this one hadn't been released on this side of the Atlantic, it was a good call to include it. There are stories the overseas version of blues included this U.S. Smash Hits version, kind of like the story that the Japanese version of King Kong versus Godzilla had Godzilla winning, but I don't believe that's the case. Catfish Blues, or Experiencing the Blues, is next. This version of the song that Jimmy did often in 1967 and early 1968 comes from a broadcast in the Netherlands from November 1967 for a show called Hepla. I hope that's right. My Dutch is a little rough. Unlike the version on Radio 1, we get the full medley that starts with Muddy Waters' Rolling Stone, goes into Still a Fool, and ends with the Cat Squirrel Spoonful finale. It's the closest we'd get to a studio version of the whole thing. On May 2nd, 1968, at the record plant, Jimmy, Mitch Mitchell, Steve Winwood, and Jack Cassidy recorded three takes of the epic blues number Voodoo Child. The one that made the album was take three. The one on this album takes pieces from all three takes and comes out to just under 9 minutes long. It's got different soloing and a really cool part where Jimmy does some really like finger tapping that I wish could have been used in the release take. Up next is Mannish Boy. Jimmy had done this song as I'm a Man with Curtis Knight. The version from Hackensack was actually in the radio show, live and unreleased. When it's done like Bo Diddley, you call it I'm a Man. When it's done like Muddy Waters, you call it Mannish Boy. Jimmy, Billy, and Buddy do it their own way. The trio spent a considerable amount of time working on it in May 1969, but ended up not doing anything with it. Like the last song, this was a combination of a couple of different takes. A bootleg of the session came out and showed there was no complete version to use, hence the editing it takes. But the odd thing is the guitar solo towards the end comes from a different part of the session from a complete take of the song. Go figure. The next song, Once I Had a Woman, was a first. The original version of a song from Crash Landing or Midnight Lightning to get a release. Instead of releasing the rumored full version of around 11 minutes, they did an edit of about 8 minutes. They also decided to mix out the harmonica player, and not a bad call in this case. Bleeding Heart is another one from the early Band of Gypsies era in May 1969. This is closer to the Royal Albert Hall version than later versions. He soon began to funk it up and turn it into the one that ended up on War Heroes. Now, the name Jelly 292 was just Alan having a little bit of fun. It's the other take of Jam 292 from Loose Ends, which was a little annoying for us here in the States since we really officially hadn't heard the original, but I had since I was lucky enough to grab an import copy at the late lamented vintage vinyl on Route 1 back in 1990. To this day, I've only seen two of the copies of Loose Ends anywhere, and I think they were both vinyl. Next is a track called Electric Church Red House.
On variations on a theme, there was a version of Red House from the TTG sessions where the band is introduced. Jimmy talks for another minute, then they kick in Red House. Only things were not what they seemed. I don't know who did the edit, but it was actually two different sessions. The introduction that included Mitch Mitchell on one set of drums and Buddy Miles on the other and Lee Michaels on organ actually comes from a jam entitled, guess what? Electric Church. Red House was recorded on the last day of the sessions on October 29th and had Lee Michaels on organ, but not Buddy Miles on another set of drums, which is why when it makes its appearance here, the band intro is cut out. The album ends with the Berkeley version of Hear My Train A-Comin' making its first appearance since Rainbow Bridge was pulled from the U.S. market almost 20 years earlier. This take includes a little bit of Hendrix talking before they go into the song. Quibbles aside, this was a fairly strong collection of blues material that mixed the rare and unreleased to give the listener an idea of how Jimmy approached the blues. The one big thing it missed was Lord, I Sing the Blues. I would have traded either Bleeding Heart or Born Under a Bad Sign for it, but overall, it was a very worthy addition to Jimmy's catalog. It says something about its quality that it's the only album from this era still in print, albeit with a few changes, like Jelly 292 going back to its original name, and the liner notes were made a little less trippy. The general public seemed to like it as well. It made the top 10 in the UK and hit 45 in the US, eventually going platinum. Jimi Hendrix, Woodstock. 1994 was the 25th anniversary of the Woodstock Music Festival, and along with a number of other celebrations and releases to mark the occasion, Alan Douglas prepared a single CD distillation of Jimmy's set, which included all the songs that appeared on the two soundtrack albums, plus a few others. But like his Isle of Wight album from a few years earlier, he did some editing and reshuffling of the set list. This time, it was a little less drastic, and thankfully, the entire half-hour medley was only slightly edited. Sorry, Larry. The full rundown was Fire, Isabella, Hear My Train A-Comin', Red House, Jam Back at the House, Voodoo Child, Star Spangled Banner, Purple Haze, Solar Improvisation, and Villanova Junction. The original Woodstock film was re-edited around this time as well to include almost another hour's worth of material, and Jimmy got an extra 5 minutes with the inclusion of the first part of Voodoo Child. Now, supposedly they almost didn't get to do that, though. A couple of years earlier, Douglas prepared a film of the Woodstock set that basically mirrored the CD, or should I say the CD mirrored the video. Again, like Isle of Wight and Atlanta, it was not for release in the U.S. But remember I told you way back in the episode with Crash Landing that he cut the original master tapes of Message of Love and Power Soul? Well, this time, the story goes, he got the Hendrix Woodstock footage from Warner Brothers and proceeded to cut the original negative. The negative Thelma Schoonmaker and Martin Scorsese worked so hard to put together. I have to wonder if it wasn't Warner Brothers who wanted to part ways with them after this little incident. Luckily, to the best of anyone's knowledge, this time nothing was thrown away. Annoyingly, that video starts with Message of Love, a song not on the CD at all. Larry Lee had his solos in Red House and Voodoo Child edited out. I think Larry had his guitar tune like regular, others say he was just flat out of tune. For some reason, though, his Red House solo sounded very good, and if you ask me, it should have been left in. So MCA had the original three albums back in print, a best of album, a brand new compilation album, and a live album. It was time to tackle the great missing piece of the Jimi Hendrix puzzle, the fourth studio album. Voodoo Soup. We now come to what is, in my opinion, the single most controversial and divisive album in the entire Hendrix catalog. And that's saying something. For whatever reason, Allen decided with the move to MCA, he'd finish the job he'd started back in 1975 and remove the last remnants of the Mike Jeffrey era from wide release, Cry of Love and the Jimi Hendrix soundtrack. The soundtrack was not really that big a deal, but Cry of Love was. This was the only vestige left of Jimmy's attempt at his next album. But not to worry. Douglas promised he'd put together an album that would represent Jimmy's vision for First Rays of the New Rising Sun. Did he succeed? Did he even come close? Or was he like Lee Marvin in Cat Ballou not being able to hit the broadside of a barn? But what the hell does voodoo soup even mean? You know, there's a picture of Jimmy having a bowl of soup which inspired Mobius to do a painting based on it for a double reissue of Are You Experienced and Axis Bold's Love in France. That inspired this cover. Is this the best they could think of? Now, they made it together to go with the other three, or four technically, you know, try to brainwash the buyer into thinking it goes along with them. Yeah. I'll talk about what's on the album first, then what's not on it. The album starts off with an unreleased song that has a familiar name and part of a familiar sound. Jimmy recorded New Rising Sun way back during the TTG sessions with him playing both guitars and drums. It sounds familiar since it's a song John Jansen used as the final part to Captain Coconut. This time, they kept a little less than half the song. It probably could have used another minute. Again, there's no evidence that Jimmy was going to use the song on the new album, but in this case, it's actually a fine way to start off the CD. Douglas then has New Rising Sun crossfade into Belly Button Window from Cry of Love. It provided a perfect closer to that album. Now, does it work as an opener or close to it? Well, not really, but there is the three-sided track listing that may or may not be in Jimmy's handwriting that has Belly Button Window as the fourth song on side one. Since there's only two guitars and Jimmy's vocals, the mix is pretty much the same. Next up is Stepping Stone. Some people just never learn. For reasons known only to Alan Douglas and Bruce Gary, both of whom are no longer with us, the decision was made to have Bruce do another whole new drum part to Stepping Stone. The excuse was that they couldn't use either drum part from Buddy or Mitch and remix the track because the parts weren't on it or something like that. But the original masters for both versions were in the estate's hands all along. It's not like they were missing. Bruce does a drum part that kind of splits the difference between Buddy and Mitch but leans closer to the original. The rest of the track is remixed from Jimmy's later overdubs at Electric Lady. Freedom was next. The remix on this track totally strips away one of Billy's overdubs and leaves just the bottom one, completely ruining the opening. That cool guitar bounce back and forth after the second chorus is gone too. It does force the vocals to the front, which is okay, but the track was mostly mixed except for the one guitar overdub that this mix also forces to the front. So why mess with it? Now, this next remix is kind of interesting. The one they did for Angel goes back to Mitch's original drum part and doesn't have a lot of echo on it. It also doesn't do the fade out, fade in at the end there. Now, while I prefer the version on Cry of Love, this one is a perfectly acceptable alternate. Room Full of Mirrors, on the other hand, this is the other track where Bruce Gary replaced the original drum part. Now, I know Eddie Kramer mentioned Jimmy had an issue with the drums, and again, the excuse was something about the tape wasn't enough fixing it. It's just a mess. The percussion that was in the background is all over the place now, except there's no more, say it with me, Christopher Walken, cowbell. Next, what's Midnight doing here? Jimmy wasn't looking at anything from April 1969 for the next album. If anything, it should have been Hear My Train a-comin'. What makes this version different from the one on War Heroes is it's 30 seconds longer and has the second guitar mixed up a little higher, but most, if not all, of Eddie's extra, like a phasing effect in the breakdown section before the song restarts up, were all removed. Nightbird Flying follows, and wow, is the echo button stuck on full? Jimmy's vocals reverberate through the song and the tempo block or stick that clicks in the background in time to the music is now spaced a bit by dropping every other one and slamming the echo on it like they dropped it down to the bottom of a well or something. Again, Jimmy finished his song and had it ready for the B-side of his new single. Why touch it at all? Say, come to think of it, where's the A-side to that single? Next is Drifting. The echo effect is a little heavy on the vocals, but they also found some other backwards guitar effects to swell up here and there, so this is also an okay alternate. Easy Rider follows, and again, Jimmy was all done with this song. Why are they going back to the original tapes and mixing it from scratch? Steve Winwood's amazingly cool vocals at the end of the song? Yeah, let's strip those of every last drop of reverb and mix it off to the side. And we also lose the fade out, fade in again. Now, even though Paley Gap wasn't set for the next album, I'm fine with it being used here since it was recorded around the same time, you know, July 1st, 1970. They also mix up the percussion nicely and leave it faded up through its cool ending that Rainbow Bridge didn't have. So this track would actually have been an improvement to the original if they hadn't cut off the first 10 to 12 seconds and then jammed the next five into the following five to shorten it by around 20 seconds. What was the point to that little exercise? Message of Love is next. Didn't you use this track before, Alan? Well, yes, but this time he took out the extra percussion and left Jimmy's mumbled words in. Still has the guitar solo he cut and pasted in from somewhere else, but overall an improvement since Chris Landing wasn't around anymore. And if you're going to use this one, though, why didn't we get a better power solo as well? Peace of Mississippi followed. Okay, now I'm really confused. If Jimmy was going to use anything from TGG, it would have either been New Rising Sun or possibly Look Over Yonder. Why would he use Peace in Mississippi, an instrumental that sounds a lot like Midnight? Use one or the other, but not both. This one is a minute longer than the one on Crash Landing, like 5.5 minutes, still missing a minute and a half, but Mitch and Noel are back on this version. The album ends with In From the Storm. This is close to the Cry of Love version, but again, with a lot of echo. At least it doesn't have that out-of-phase drum effect that Jimmy was trying for on his August 22nd mix. So to reflect the possible double album, Alan gives us 57 minutes worth. What wasn't used that may have been in contention for the next album? Well, from Cry of Love, My Friend, Straight Ahead, and Astro Man. From Rainbow Bridge, Dolly Dagger, Earth Blues, Look Over Yonder, and Hey Baby. From War Heroes, Bleeding Heart, Beginning, and Isabella, and from Loose Ends, Come Down Hard on Me, and Drifter's Escape. Heck, throw in Power of Soul, and you could have thrown darts at a wall and picked up four more songs for the album that would have fit in just fine. So what was Alan's overriding criteria for picking songs for this album? What the kids would like. I'm sorry, the kids? The kids who weren't born when Jimmy died? If you're trying to do a version of Jimmy's next album, you can't be aiming at an audience that literally did not exist. This mindset led him to make sure that Dolly Dagger did not make the album because his daughter didn't like it. Well, that settles it then. Never mind Jimmy had done a final mix, sent it to Reprise, and practically went to the pressing plant himself to make this the lead single off the album. No, Alan's daughter didn't like it, so off to the dustbin of history. Oh, and take Isabella with you. She didn't like that one either. Trying to do First Rays without Dolly Dagger and Hey Baby is like trying to do the Beach Boys smile without Heroes and Villains and Surf's Up or Lifehouse without Pure and Easy and Bob O'Reilly. You can't do it. Dolly Dagger and Hey Baby were the centerpieces of First Rays of the New Rising Sun. There's pretty much no doubt about it. And even if you leave off Hey Baby since it's not done, you don't have that excuse with Dolly Dagger. Maybe that's why he decided to go for the much catchier title, Voodoo Soup. You also have to remember that at the time, this was it. This was Jimmy's fourth album. Cry of Love was gone, over, done. Whatever didn't come out of Voodoo Soup, you likely weren't going to get it. As part of why the reaction to the album was, well, vehement. It made it up to number 66, but was gone after less than 2 months on the charts. Right around that time, Alan made an announcement he'd work on one more project and retire from the Hendrix stewardship. His final project was to be entitled On the Road, and possibly it was going to look like this. It'd start with Purple Haze from Blackpool 1967. This ended up later as a bonus feature on a DVD. Then it would have been followed by Hey Joe and Wild Thing from Monterey, again, and Johnny B. Good, again. He'd then take a couple from Woodstock, Jam Back the House, and the Improvisation, I guess just that little five-minute segment. Then he'd release, for the first time, something from the actual Rainbow Bridge soundtrack, the medley of Hey Baby and In From the Storm. It would have finished up along The Watchtower and Red House from Atlanta, and Voodoo Child from Berkeley. I'd assume it would have been the one from the second show that's featured in the film. There was also a VHS compilation that popped up in Europe in late 1995 that I take it would have been a companion project to On the Road, entitled Festivals. It included footage from Monterey, Woodstock, Atlanta, and Isle of Wight. From Monterey, it had Rock Me Baby. From Woodstock, it had Foxy Lady, though actually that one might have been from Monterey too, as well as the Star Spangled Banner, Purple Haze, Improvisation, Villanova Junction sequence. From Atlanta, it had Fire and Rent House, and from Isle of Wight, it would have had God Save the Queen and some portion of Machine Gun. As a diehard Hendrix fan, my reaction to these would have been, kind of on par with the 80s Capitol releases. Nice to have, but sort of piecemeal. Why they didn't just keep Monterey in print, I don't know. It would have been nice to get some of the Maui material in the Berkeley Voodoo Child out, but how about bringing back some of the older In the West songs into print? Whatever Alan's plans were, they came to an abrupt halt. It seemed when the catalog sale to MCA was worked out, Jimmy's dad, Al Hendrix, filed a legal protest. About 2 years later, a settlement was reached, and Al received control of the rights to Jimmy's work, image, everything. He and his stepdaughter Janie formed a new company called Experience Hendrix, which will handle everything going forward. So what is Alan Douglas's legacy with Jimi Hendrix? A fair summation would be mixed. His entire 20-year stewardship cannot be shrugged off and dismissed, but there were definite issues. If he kept the original musicians on the majority of tracks on Crash Landing and later Midnight Lightning, as I mentioned, maybe trying a track or two with the studio musicians as an experiment, I think he'd be viewed a little differently. It was a different mindset back then, and considering how Jimmy'd been treated by Ed Chalpin and to some extent Mike Jeffrey, they probably thought a personal friend would do a better job looking out for his legacy. And there were a number of solid releases. The Jimi Hendrix Concert, Jimmy Plays Monterey, the Ryko Winterland album, and Blues generally topped the list of the best things of the Douglas era. The overdubbing on the albums in 1975 and 1995, and the mini whatever Johnny B. Goode was, are probably the worst decision, and those interviews for Voodoo Soup. I know how ticked off I was after I read them. Little did we know, within 2 years, we'd finally have First Rays of the New Rising Sun in our hands. And it still wasn't right. Next time, Jimmy's family takes control of his catalog and legacy and brings an old friend back into the fold to get the music sounding kind of like Jimmy wanted. That's next time on Keep on Groovin'. Please remember to hit the subscribe button if you like what you're hearing. Happy birthday to King this weekend. He's probably the only guy with a posthumous catalog that's bigger than Jimmy's. I'm John Hartrock. Thanks for listening.